The following audio is from Park Church in Denver, Colorado. More information about Park Church is available online at parkchurchdenver.org.
Good morning, Park Church. This morning's reading is Revelation 13. If you don't have a Bible with you this morning, you can find one in a pew back nearby. Looks like this. And if you don't have one at home, please take that with you as a gift from us. So again, we're going to be in Revelation 13. If you are reading from the Pewback Bible, it's page 1035. Revelation 13, starting in verse 1. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to the dragon gave its power and his throne and great authority. One of the heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?" And the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opens its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them, and authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation, and all who dwell on earth will worship him, everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world, in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive to captivity, he goes. If anyone is to be slain with a sword must he be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had 2 horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, and whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on the earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. And it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. This is the word of the Lord.
Good morning. A week ago, I was in Paris. Gary said some sort of snide comment last week about me drawing a short straw. And we were sitting in a small office room, office building, with chairs packed into every single corner, worshiping Jesus, I think. I didn't quite understand any of the words except for Jesu, which sounded like Jesus. So worshiping with a community that was planted in Paris 10 months ago, largely through our gifts, to support and see a church started in the heart of Paris. That night, we had dinner with a number of people from the church there, and there was an old guy in his 70s who sat there and was an encyclopedia of knowledge in terms of the history of the church in Paris. And he told, I just asked, how did he come to join this church? And he said, I actually am a member of a church in the suburbs of Paris. I take the train in. When I heard that a church was starting in Châtelet, and when I heard that a church was starting where there has not been an evangelical witness to the death and resurrection of Jesus, starting in the very heart of Paris, and there hasn't been one for 100 years, I said, I must go and be a part of this. And so we got to sit and hear stories from this old guy, and gather with a church that wasn't there a year ago. We are supporting a church planting movement in the very heart of one of the most important cities in Europe, in the world, the gateway city to Western Africa and North Africa. And it's an amazing thing that God has invited us into as a church body. And it was an honor. It was a gift of God's grace. I was sitting on the front row, and they started singing and clapping and worshiping Jesus. And I just, tears streaming down my face as I just thought about, and this wasn't here a year ago. There was no one in this district of Paris with over 200,000 people. There was no one in this city proclaiming, singing, celebrating, believing, confessing who Jesus is and what Jesus has done. It is an amazing thing to be a part of. We're going to tell more and more stories in the months ahead. We're actually one of the coordinators over there for this church planting movement that we're a part of is going to come and preach to us in June. And it's an exciting and amazing thing to be a part of. I've got two announcements for you, and then we'll get to the weirdness. The first thing is Easter is coming. Not next week. Next week is Palm Sunday. The following week will be Easter Sunday. We are not gathering in this room on Easter. We're going to come together. All three services are going to come together and worship together Easter morning downtown at the Ellie Calkins Opera House. And so we're going to have one big service, one big loud celebration of what we believe to be the greatest event in all of history. The morning that marks the defeat of death, the conquering of sin, and when God came to liberate his people and to redeem them as he raised Jesus from the dead. And so we're going to gather downtown. We're going to sing. We're going to worship. We're going to baptize some friends. If you would like to be baptized, if you haven't been baptized, if you've recently come to faith in Jesus, and would like to confess together and celebrate together that not only did God raise Jesus from the dead, but by raising him from the dead, he's raised us from the dead. we would love for you to, on the city, we'll have more information about how to get baptized. You can also just contact Gary. Gary at parkchurchdenver.org, and we'll get you lined up to be baptized on Easter morning. But we're going to celebrate then. There are a bunch of these cards, and we've put them everywhere, all over the place. You're supposed to take these and give them to friends, give them to family, give them to coworkers to come eat with us on Easter afternoon, worship Jesus with us Easter morning. Good Friday, kind of service times and all that is listed on here as well. A number of events that are going on. Not this week, but the following week. So we're excited to kind of get ramped up and celebrate together what we believe to be the highest moment in history. The reason why we're here this morning is because of what we celebrate this week. So take those cards, give them away, show up, worship Jesus with us. The last thing I want to mention to you before we pray is on April 25th. I want to make sure I get the date right. We are hosting a women's conference that morning. We've invited Hannah Anderson to come and speak. She is the author of what I think is one of the best books on calling and identity that I've read, called Made for More. And she will be here speaking to our women. So women, please mark that date on your calendar. We'd love to have you that morning. You can find out more information in the weeks ahead. And we'll also have information online if you want to find out more. Let me pray. Father, I fear that though we sing these songs and we read these words and we pray these prayers, we are deceived. Not by the words, not by the songs, not by the prayers, but by life lived in the midst of a world where we largely feel at ease, where we feel mostly at home. We don't fear what we're supposed to fear. We don't tremble or feel even a bit of anxiety about the world in which we live. And so we don't know how to celebrate the redemption that's been given to us by Jesus because we don't understand the danger we're in when we live our lives in the midst of this world. And so God, I pray that you would come and you'd help us to become aware this morning that we have an enemy, that this enemy has schemes, he has deceived us, that this enemy has plans that he has unfolded throughout history. And then God, I pray that you would help us not to think for a moment that we can defeat that enemy, but to find this morning the rest that comes from knowing that the Lamb has won the victory, that he has conquered, that he has redeemed, that he has rescued, and that he has adopted. So God, help us to see, help us to tremble, and help us to leave here confident, not in our own minds, our own ways, our own actions, our own wills, but deeply resting, deeply confident in what you've already accomplished for us in Jesus. In your name we pray, amen. For the most part of my childhood centered around a forest that lay kind of just outside of my neighborhood in Texas. Now, granted, it was Texas, and in this part of Texas, they don't have forests, they have fields of bushes. But as a small child, these fields of bushes felt like a forest because it was mesquite trees. And so I remember as a six-year-old going over to a friend's house, his friend backed up to this forest, and I'd never been in this forest before, and we went with his older brother to see and discover what became a magical, albeit on further reflection kind of disgusting, but a magical place. They'd found an old couch in these woods. And they'd taken this old couch, and there's very few things more disgusting than an old couch. They'd taken this old couch, they'd dug in a hole kind of around the couch, they'd leaned kind of wood and various things that they'd found in the woods around the couch, and this was our fort, it was our kingdom, it was our castle, and it was an amazing place. I have fond memories of playing in the forest. I remember as a sixth grader, we had all bought BB guns or convinced our parents to buy us BB guns, and so we had BB gun wars out in that forest until two kids had to go to the hospital. It was just a wonderful, happy, glorious place. And this is where we wanted to go play. Anytime it wasn't raining, we would all go to Michael's house, we'd all meet there, and then we'd go out into the forest, and we had games that we would play. Everything changed about our perspective of those woods when one day a story began to circulate. It was on the news, and my mom heard it, all of our parents heard it, and it changed how we played in those woods. You see, on the other side of those woods was just an old country road that had a dead end at where it met a lake, Little Lake Wichita. And at the end of that road was kind of the favorite haunt of one of the town drug dealers. The police had gotten word of this, that they'd gone to arrest the guy. He'd fled from his car as he saw the police coming down this long, straight, narrow country road, fled into those woods, and they'd never caught him. Now, this story began to circulate. This story was told to us by our parents, and it was largely told to say, hey, if you see some stranger, or you see policemen, or you hear noises, you should go back to Michael's house immediately. Don't play, don't talk, don't, you know. But in our minds, as little sixth graders, the story that we heard was this man escaped into our magical woods with our magical fort, which very few people could find, and he had never been found, which in our minds didn't mean that he got out of the woods. It was that he's still in the woods, because if he'd come out of the woods, he would have been caught. He's still in the woods. So suddenly this magical place, suddenly this place where we would play all the time, where we had kind of grown up for years, just going out into those woods, was no longer a place of safety. Now there's an enemy there. And never in our wildest dreams had we imagined that there was danger in those woods. Sure, there was a time that the kid got shot through the lip with the BB. There was the occasional ticks that came from the fort. It's disgusting. Anyway, there was those kinds of relative dangers, but no real danger, no real harm, no real enemy that there was there to lie to us, that was there to deceive us, that was potentially there to destroy us. Last week, Gary introduced us into this kind of new section in the book of Revelation. And at the heart of the message that was held out to us from Revelation 12 was simply this fact. There's a dragon. There's a dragon who's furious. A dragon who from the very, very beginning has been attempting to, fighting to, warring to unravel all of the good works that God has done, all of the good creation that God has wrought, all of the good people that God has redeemed by his grace and by his mercy, that this dragon is making war. If you remember with me from verse 17, then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And he stood on the sand of the sea. Here was a picture a story of a forest that's no longer magical. It's no longer marked by safety and fun and laughter and simply a place and a world that we can go out into, oblivious to the fact there is one who has declared war on us. There is one who seeks to destroy us. There is one who seeks to deceive us and enslave us to darkness forever and ever and ever. We step into chapter 13 now, where John, as he begins to expand on this vision that Jesus is giving to him, he's going to unfold for us, man, a picture of that this dragon doesn't only exist. He has strategies. He has plans. He has things that he's been doing from the very, very beginning that we need to be aware of. And so before we step into the details of the text, I want us to get kind of a big picture overview of the nature of the work of this dragon, the nature of the work of this enemy that is all around us and always at work. The first and kind of most basic thing for us to see, but very, very important, is how many beasts are there in this text? You're not going to see it up here. There's three beasts. We have the dragon, and everything around this dragon portrays authority, portrays a kind of glorious, almost divine-like authority as he exists and as he wages war. But then you have the two beasts that are listed here in chapter 13. And there's something about these beasts and the fact that there's three of them that we need to take note of. First, this first beast, he arises out of the sea. He looks like a king. He carries the authority and the power of a king. And most notably, he has a mortal wound from which apparently he's been raised from the dead from. So we have one that has almost divine-like authority, and we have another one who's declared, who's labeled, who's marked out as a king, who's apparently was dead but is now alive. And then we have this third beast, this beast that arises out of the earth, out of the land, and his whole role, his whole identity is to call people, his ministry, if you will, is to call people to see, to delight in, and to worship this beast who rose out of the sea, who had a mortal wound and was raised from the dead. Does this sound like anything? Now, interwoven into that is this warning, this idea, as John is identifying for us who this dragon is, this Satan. He describes him as the one who deceives all who dwell on the whole earth. And then in chapter 13, the second beast is described as the one in verse 14. He deceives all the earth dwellers, all those who dwell upon the earth. In other words, the work of the dragon to destroy us, the work of the dragon to enslave us, is the work of deception. It's not fundamentally, although it expresses itself in some way, we'll talk about this in a minute. It's not fundamentally that he comes with swords and shields and guns to make war on the people of God in a sort of frontal attack. No, he intends to deceive us. And he intends to deceive us by looking like the very thing that we worship. A kind of mock trinity, if you will. But with the dragon exercising or attempting to usurp the authority of the Father. This second beast being raised from the dead, attempting to kind of co-opt the identity of Jesus himself. And this third beast cultivating and trying to work, much as the Spirit works, to draw us to worship the King, to worship this one who was raised from the dead. And so as a broad overview, just one, beginning with the idea that we have an enemy, but two, now as we begin to try to understand from chapter 13 how this enemy works, you need to see that his primary, his most fundamental work that he's doing in the world is simply to lie to you, to deceive you in some of the most in some of the most subtle and painful and devastating ways imaginable. Not to slaughter you, not to wage war on you with swords and shields and guns and prisons, but to wage war on you by simply and pervasively lying to you. Another interesting thing is we begin to work our way through the effects of the work of the dragon and what the dragon is actually seeking to do. We find that this growing in the next few chapters, this tale of two cities, this one city constructed and built by the beasts and the dragon, this city that is called the great prostitute, the great whore. A dark city that, again, attempts to deceive the people of God and attempts to flood the earth with not the worship of the Lamb, not the righteousness and the goodness and the justice and the peace and the love that comes from the one who sits upon the throne, but rather with darkness, with slavery, with destruction, with never-ending unrest. And as the work of the Lamb begins to unfold, we see contrasted with this this great city, this great prostitute of a city, the city that belongs to the Lamb, that God is building a city that reflects His glory, His goodness, His righteousness. And so we come to this chapter and see a world, a history divided. And at the heart of it is a scheming dragon that simply seeks to lie to you. Now, how does he lie? There are two beasts now that express the will of this dragon, and it's important that we look at these beasts. And so look with me at verse 1. He said, "I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its head. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's. Lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast." And so we've got something coming out of the sea, and his description of it is it has 10 horns, 7 heads, and 10 diadems or crowns on its horns. Now, endless attempts have been made to try to identify the tens and the sevens with specific people or specific empires or nation states that have arisen throughout history. And so, you can go back to the history of the interpretation of the book of Revelation, and you'll say, hey, this guy over here, the Russian Empire was, it's always the Russians and it's usually Americans saying it, that's this horn, and then there's Egypt and then there's Rome, and trying to kind of line things out and really arbitrarily trying to draw lines and connections between horns and diadems and heads and history. And I think that's missing the point. Well, one of the things that we've seen over and over again in the book of Revelation is that the way that it uses numbers is rarely, if ever, to draw attention to one specific moment or person in history. Now, particularly when we see the numbers 10 or the number 7 or the numbers 3, they're all trying to communicate one kind of big but really basic idea. And it's simply the idea of fullness or wholeness. And so I don't think we'd be wise to take the 10 horns and the 7 heads and the 10 crowns and try to line that out in history as much as to see the picture that John is drawing for us through this vision that Jesus is giving him is a picture of a kind of universal and seemingly absolute authority. And not just authority. The horns specifically carry with them the notion of authority, but the crowns, we tend to associate crowns with authority, but in John's day, crowns had far more to do with glory and honor and being recognized. So if you won, if you won a contest, if you won the Olympics, you'd be given a crown, not a medal. And the idea was the crown was a mark for you of glory. It was a mark by which you would be recognized and seen. And so the picture of this beast is a beast that deceives, but his identity is one that seems to have universal authority, but one that seems to have a kind of universally recognized glory and honor about him. Two other things I want us to note about this first beast. One, there's this weird description. He's like a leopard, his feet are like a bear's, his mouth was like a lion's mouth. Odd description, if you try to combine all of those. It's like a not very fast leopard with a big mouth. But that this image is actually being drawn from Daniel chapter 7. And in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel sees a vision of the great enemy of mankind. And these beasts that he describes, they kind of all come together as a description of the one who seeks to destroy us, the one who seeks to deceive us. It is a leopard, a bear, and a lion. The idea being is you can't run from him. The idea being you can't fight him. The idea being that once he catches you, he devours you. The other thing I want to draw attention to is the emphasis on blasphemy in the role of this beast. And I think it's here that we kind of find a key to understanding who this beast or what this beast is. There's two different ways that the Bible uses the terminology of blasphemy, and I think both are included here. The first is simply an attempt to curse God. It's an attempt to spit in his face, to make a mockery of who he is. I just saw that Kanye West has come out with his own Bible, which translates everywhere. It says God translated to Kanye. And so I didn't know whether to think it was funny or terrifying. I was preaching this text, so I decided on terrifying. And it's this idea of spitting in the face of God, mocking God, belittling God, doing anything you can to mock who he is in his holiness. The second meaning, though, of the word blasphemy isn't like that. If you remember, Jesus was indicted on charges of blasphemy. It wasn't because he was spitting in the face of God. It wasn't because he was making a mockery of God. No, he was indicted on charges of blasphemy because he claimed to be God. He claimed the authority of God. He claimed to be the Son of God, being equal to God. Not by mocking God, not by spitting in God's face, not by burning down the temple, but by simply claiming who he was. And so we see in this first beast, you know, two fundamental identities. He spits and mocks and burns the identity of God. He hates God and he speaks with venom about who he is. But he also just simply makes claims that God is unnecessary. That he's replaced God. That God is somehow in the work, in the ministry of this beast, that God is now marginalized. Well, I just came back from France, so let's go ahead and rip on the French. In 1789, the French Revolution broke out. The French Revolution as a movement largely struck at two fundamental ideas, which in the end were distilled into one. It began with an utter and complete rejection of the monarchy, of the authority of any kings or court or special class. And so they stormed the Louvre. They dragged everybody out, put a bunch of art in there instead. They dragged out the dignitaries, dragged out the court, beheaded them, killed them, hung them, ran them through with a sword. And they declared war on what was seen at the time as the divinely appointed king of France. But they didn't stop there. They saw a connection that we in America have severed. They saw the connection between the king and God. And so it wasn't simply a rejection of monarchy as a form of government. You see, they left the palace and they went to the cathedral of Notre Dame. I kept wanting to say Notre Dame every time in France because it sounds better. It was Notre Dame. So they go to Notre Dame and they immediately drag out all the clergy. They run them out of town. They kill a number of them. And then here's what interestingly happens at Notre Dame. The first thing that happens is the first form of blasphemy. They cleared everything out. They smashed the altar. They smashed windows. They quite literally burned great parts of the cathedral. They spit in the face and made fun of the clergy. And then they turned the temple, the cathedral of Notre Dame into the Temple of Reason. And the mark of the Temple of Reason was that they filled the place with beasts. They made sacrifices of pigs in the middle of this massive and beautiful building. And they did anything they could to defile what that building represented to the people of France, which was the authority of God, the throne of God, the grace of God, the beauty of God, the kindness of God. They blasphemed it. They cursed it. They spit on it. They defecated the place. But then another thing happened. 1793. The reign of terror has kind of taken hold. And one of the leaders of the movement at that point recognized that this wasn't subtle enough. This was too shocking. They needed to do something different. So they go into the cathedral. They clean out the cathedral. They get all the dead animals out of the cathedral. They do some repairs in the cathedral. But rather than reasserting the worship of Jesus and reasserting the worship of the one who sits upon the throne of God himself, no, they made the thing, they called it, they actually etched it at the very top of the center door. This is a temple to reason, a temple to a deity. A deity, a temple to a higher power. And they began to cultivate throughout France, beginning there at the Temple of Notre Dame, this idea that yes, there is something called God, a God that's somehow associated with reason, but we shouldn't name him. We shouldn't get too specific on who he is. But we need the place of religion. It just must be marginalized. And so we see here the second form of blasphemy. Not the spitting in the face of God. Not the declaring of war upon anyone who claims that God actually exists. But a far, far, far more subtle deception. Oh, he's there. Probably. But he's irrelevant. You can have liberty. You can have joy. You can have community. But you don't need him. He's just over there. This is the great deception. Oh, we still see in our day men and women dragged out on beaches and beheaded because they worship the Lamb. But far more predominant for us, it is the subtle an oblivious belief that you can have everything you want. You can have the good life. You can have joy. You can have a flourishing family. You can have a meaningful career. You can attain retirement and security and happiness and all that you long for. And God is utterly irrelevant to that pursuit. This is secularism. Not the fringe, angry atheists who war against belief in all its forms, but the subtle, pervasive belief that we are surrounded by, that God simply doesn't matter. Say your prayers, go to church. If you want to have some odd sort of sexual ethic about your life, fine. But for the stuff that really matters, God doesn't matter. And so, running throughout the whole of history, it is not a series of empires, it's not a series of governments, it's not to be particularly identified with one ruler or Napoleon or Gorbachev or Putin or Obama or Bush or whoever. No, running throughout the whole of history, it is the subtle yet almost universally held belief God is irrelevant. His throne doesn't matter. Everything you want in life, everything you desire in life can be attained without him. And so the first beast. The second beast then. The second beast is identified very much with a sort of cultivation of a religious kind of worship. His whole work, his whole ministry, his whole job is to point away from himself, to not call attention to himself, but rather to call attention to this first beast, this beast of whom it is said, who can stand against the beast? I mean, who can stand in the face of the force of history and philosophy and culture and society? This beast cultivates a kind of religious worship around this current that runs throughout the whole of history. And he does so with manifestations, visible manifestations of seeming incomparable beauty and glory. It's as though he takes the scene that John beautifully paints for us in Revelation chapter 4 and 5, this beautiful scene of the throne of God surrounded by light and color and beauty and glory and majesty and sovereignty, and he co-opts it and he begins to mimic it in kind of a mocking sort of way. Have you ever stood in the middle of Times Square? I remember coming up out of the subway and standing there in the middle, surrounded by images and light and beauty and glory, and God is nowhere to be seen. You can walk a block and a half and see Times Square Church, I guess, but lights and names and images and color and beauty everywhere. All screaming the same thing. You want the good life? You can have it. You can have fame. You can have satisfaction. You can have rest. You can have joy. You can be made much of. And I mean, if you want to worship God, that's kind of your thing, I guess. You see, the great deception is that you don't need God. The even greater deception that magnifies it, that runs throughout the whole of history, and I can't help but think, like it's almost been perfected in our age, is the idea that you can have beauty, you can have glory, you can have rest, you can have joy, you can have satisfaction, you can have anything you want if you'll simply serve the first beast. This is the great deception. The lie that comes to enslave. The lie that comes to destroy. The lie that comes to enslave us forever and ever and ever in darkness. And I think the key to seeing how all of this works is that strange and weird number, 666. We're going to unveil this morning on the screen who that is. You're going to be shocked because he's in this room. Sorry. If we had $100, and some of you are like, oh, shoot. about $100 for every moment in history somebody's identified, hey, this is who 666 points to and identifies. You see, in kind of the history of the church, for those of you that didn't grow up in strange places that actually had those conversations, the history of the church, 666 was seen as a code, and if you could break the code, you could identify who the Antichrist is, you could identify who the great deceiver is, you could identify the great evil person is. And so if I had $100 for every person that's been identified, I could retire, you could all retire if I was generous, and my kids would never work. And it would be a beautiful, beautiful thing. I mean, we have, in the Reformation, you had an interesting deal going on. You had Luther saying the Pope was the meaning of 666. You had the Pope saying that Luther was the meaning of 666, so it left everyone confused. I remember growing up and during the age called the Cold War. Now, most of you weren't born yet, but the Cold War was a time when Russia and America didn't like each other at all. So, I remember growing up, that Gorbachev, that they had figured out some code, that Gorbachev's name was actually, you could distill it down to 666, and he was the Antichrist. I come from a strange state where when Obama was elected, I got emails that had this very elaborate code. I'm not going to say where this, you know, these friends live, but it's a large place. It's a state, and everything's larger there. So they sent me, deeply disturbed emails about Obama. Clearly, if you change the O and multiply it times 4 to the third power, then it all comes out 666. And so, and then I'm sure like there's a code somewhere we could get Brian Curtis Brown. Just told you my middle name. Sorry. You could twist it, and we'd have 666. And now, who's leading your church? So you have all kinds of, in the history of this book, one of the strangest places to go is try to figure out what does 666 mean. But I want to call us back to remember when we're looking at numbers in the book of Revelation, their symbolic power is not in through kind of coming up with some sort of secret mathematical equation. Their symbolic power doesn't come from trying to identify them with one specific person or one specific kind of epic in history or empire in history. Their symbolic power comes through what the numbers tend to mean as you pull them all together. And so we have three sixes. And the interesting thing about this number, John actually calls it the number of a man, or the number of man. And you have first a series of three. And we already talked about this today. Three always carries with this idea of completion or wholeness. And so we have something that's whole, something that's complete. But then you have three sixes. And really the most important thing for you to know about the sixes is they're not sevens. They're incomplete. They're unsatisfied. And so the mark that is placed upon everyone, everyone not rescued and redeemed and finding rest in Jesus. It's devastating, isn't it? It's not just the rich or the poor. It's not just this socioeconomic group or that socioeconomic group. It's not just the freed ones or the slaves. It is all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave. They are marked on the right hand or the forehead. On right hand having to do with what you do in life, your power, your authority, kind of your great work that you pour out your life to. Your forehead being your very identity. Your identity now is marked by a complete incompleteness. An always striving for rest, but never finding it. A constant laboring for identity, but never having one. A yearning that drives and defines you for glory, but never seeing it. There was a movie that came out. I mentioned it, and one person came up to me after the nine and told me they'd seen it, which made me a little more confident mentioning it in the service. It was called Serenity. I don't know if you saw it. It makes me out to be kind of a bit of a nerdy sci-fi guy. It's okay, though. So in Serenity, they go to a planet. This government has done an experiment on the planet, and the experiment has gone awry, devastatingly awry, and it's produced two different things. One, this whole group of people that are dead. They literally, the experiment was done, and they fell asleep and died. But this other group of people who were exposed to the same experiment, they've gone crazy. They're called Reavers, and they're like monsters. They just go, kill, and they're kind of the bad aliens in the sci-fi movie. Sorry, I'm a little bit nervous about what you're thinking about me right now. I'm also a little nervous that, anyway. So you've got the Reavers and you've got the dead people. And so the kind of the heroines of the story arrive on this planet, and they see what's happened. They're starting to kind of get an understanding of what's gone on. And they're seeing all of these dead bodies. They've also experienced these monsters coming after them in deep, dark space. And they sit there and one of the guys stands there and he looks out at this planet. He says, "What happened here?" And there's a character in the movie, and she's kind of the, because experiments have been done to her, she's half crazy, but she also has this pithy way of kind of making observations and statements throughout the movie that kind of unlock what's happening in front of you. And she said, "They couldn't lay down. They could never find rest. They were driven to death or madness, because they were completely incomplete." See, the great work of the dragon is not to raise up some secret empire, some one world nation, some antichrist figure like that. No, it's to deceive you into thinking you can have rest, you can have joy, you can have fulfillment, you can have identity, you can have everything you want, and you don't need God. And he has deceived us all. We chase after money, never having enough. We chase after love and intimacy and sex, and we never have enough. We maybe come to Colorado to chase after play, endless ski slopes and mountains to climb, and we never have enough. We try to drown out the pain, and it's never enough. We do everything we can, chasing after chasing after chasing, and never arriving. And then here's what I believe the most terrifying part about it, is that there's three sixes. Joyfully oblivious to our slavery. Never having enough, and yet happily pursuing more and more and more and more. There is in the mark of those who belong to the dragon a satisfaction in our dissatisfaction, a delight, dare I say, an insanity in the very things that destroy us. This is our great deception. But we worship a lamb who does not speak as a dragon, but speaks words of life. We obey and serve a king, not who usurps authority, who pretends to exercise authority. No, but the one who sits in the middle of the heavens, who sits at the middle of the universe and exercises forever and ever and ever an absolute and good kind of authority. We have been rescued and redeemed, not by one who seeks to enslave us into the endless labor of our hands or identity or chasing after pleasure somewhere, but one who has redeemed us and rescued us and adopted us as sons and daughters. No, man, we have been loved. Not by one who holds the promise of love out to us as an endless carrot to be chased after, but no, but one whose love goes on and on and on and on. He sings over us to do us good. Come to Jesus and find rest. Come to Jesus and find joy. Come to this throne, bow the knee, and find one in whom you will never know the ends of his glory, his beauty, and his goodness. Do not be deceived. Worship the Lamb. Let's pray. And so, Father, the one who truly reigns forever and ever and ever, the one to whom all glory belongs, through and because of the work of your Son, the one who truly was dead and truly was raised, the one whose crowns are not usurped, they're not fake crowns, they're not deceptive crowns, they're real crowns, crowns of glory and honor that belong to Jesus forever and ever. And through the ongoing work of your Spirit, even in this room right now, pointing us to worship the Lamb. God, I pray that you would come, that you would open our eyes to see the glorious good news, that we don't have to be deceived. We don't have to enter into an eternal, endless pursuit of something we will never attain. No, you come and you give the gift of righteousness, of joy, of identity, of love. You give us rest. So God, I pray that you would come, and for all who are here, all of us who still, even this morning, are deceived, you'd call us to yourself. For those in this room who don't even realize there's a war going on, call them to yourself. God, open our eyes and let us come to Jesus. In your name we pray, amen.